We're just going to ask you to join us here on the panel, and I'm going to call up a few other panelists at this time. So, Catherine, if you can take your seat there right at the front, and we will then ask for Gordon King to come on up. And Gordon King is a resource specialist with Canadian Baptist Ministries. He's based in Winnipeg, and he's had a long passion for Christian witness on the margins. He's a writer. He's got many vocational interests, combining community and New Testament theology. And together with Dr. Nelson and Terry Smith, he co-authored Going Global, a book about mission in the new days. And so this is Gordon King. So Gordon, thank you for joining us. And then we've got Dr. Terry LeBlanc. We'll bring up Terry. Terry is actually a program elder for the Bachelor of Education here. He is the director of the North American Institute for Indigenous Theological Studies. Terry is a vital resource to those of us in the media world. He's from the Mi'kmaq Nation. He's founding chair of the Indigenous Pathways Group as well. And he's got a lifetime experience of community work. And we should mention also that Terry is a recipient of a very prestigious award. He has received the Dr. E. H. Johnson Memorial Award for Innovation in Mission. And another famous name you may know on that is Bishop Desmond Tutu received that as well. And so Terry's a Canadian treasure for us. Then we'll also call up Dr. Reverend David Wells. And David is the General Superintendent of the Pentecostal Assemblies of Canada. And if one church isn't enough to keep track of, he gets to keep track of 1,100 churches and their pastors and their problems and all those kinds of things, 3,500 ministers, and almost 250,000 Canadians are in his basket to represent. And he's been on the executive boards of the World Fellowship of Pentecostals, the World Assemblies, and the Charismatic Churches of North America. He's been chair of the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada. Little interesting thing, though, about David, he loves competitive sports. And he was chair for the Vancouver Olympic Organization's multi-faith community. But his own record-holding title is he served as Canadian chaplain for 5 sets of Olympic Games, 2 Pan Am Games, and 4 Commonwealth Games. So please welcome our distinguished panel, and we're going to chat with them. Well, we have a lot to think about, and Terry, I think we should start with you. What's your reaction to the challenge that Catherine has given us?
Well, Catherine and I had the chance to rehearse this in Regent last year, so I'm always impressed with what Catherine presents and the manner in which she presents it. It's winsome. It's an opportunity for people who might be dissenters and disengagers to really engage well with the stories and obviously the scientific content. One thing that struck me, Catherine, was when you talked about I had to make notes. I'm old and I forget easily. We've known. So it's really not an issue of knowledge.
Yeah.
We've agreed. It's really not an issue of agreement. We've been talking about it for a long time. So it's really not an issue of conversation. It really is an issue of commitment. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that one of the areas of conversation that perhaps has been minimal to this whole thing that in our community we would want to bring to the fore would be, we're still talking about it in a very anthropocentric way. We're still talking about it as if human beings are the center of this universe, as part of the creation. But we are a part of, not the entirety of. And so we tend to step back from the rest of creation, if you will, as if we're distanced from it and have the capacity to do with it as we will. So it strikes me we have to commit ourselves to thinking differently about our place within the rest of creation, not as separated from, but as an interrelated, interdependent, and interconnected part of it.
That is a really good challenge for us. Tell us a little more what that means.
Anthropocentric. Human-centered.
Human-centered.
Human-centered. So when we discuss, so if I talk to my theology students about a creation theology, and many Christian folk in particular, people of faith, talk about going out into creation. So let's go out and see what creation is all about. And I say, well, if you're not part of creation, then what the heck are you? So there's this sense in which we push it out there, And when we discuss climate, it's something happening out there, and we're not either affected by or affecting it. And that's been a part of the difficulty, because we don't see ourselves as woven into it. We see ourselves rather as distanced from it. You know, and some of that comes from the theologies that, well, a good deal of it comes from the theologies that we have learned.
Okay, Gordon, let's hear from you. What's your reaction when you hear this challenge tonight?
One of my great interests and passions has been around issues of hunger. And I found those slides on global temperature increase and falling crop production to be almost apocalyptic, because during the time frame in which temperature will be increasing, so will population. And I wondered, where do you see hope in this?
Catherine, why don't you answer that now? Where do you see hope?
Sure. I don't see hope in our scientific projections. There's been a number of articles over the past year about the anxiety and existentialist despair of a climate scientist. But where I do see hope is in people. Mm-hmm. I see that real change is happening. I see that ingenuity is being brought to bear as we recognize the issue, which is what we as scientists are good at doing, is diagnosing the problem. We are not so much the people who fix it as the people who diagnose it. Then people are recognizing, oh, we have to do things differently. We have to think of new ways to grow our crops that are more sustainable, different types of crops that give us more food. So the ingenuity is being brought to bear as we see the problem being expressed.
Okay, and David Wells, you've heard the word on hope, but what was your reaction when you heard these slides tonight in Catherine's presentation?
Thanks, Lorna, and great listening to you tonight, Catherine. And I guess I envision this room filled with, say, 250,000 people or more, and I envisioned the breakdown of our folks and understanding how they would respond to tonight, and the big job that we have to move people from a sense, there would be some deniers, there's no doubt about it, maybe in most of our Christian communities, but definitely in mine. But the bigger group would be those who see this as the natural outworking towards the final day. And of course, it's going to go there.
And world's going to burn.
Yeah. And so it's a case of theology, yes, but probably deeper is theological vision. What do you do with the fact that God is creator? So instead of human-centered, start theocentered. Okay, what did he intend for creation? Do the whole biblical narrative, Genesis to the Revelation, his work through Christ, the work of the Spirit to be the life giver, and how do you educate 250,000 people about why you think that would actually lead to proactivity rather than passivity? And so
Catherine,
some light thoughts for you.
Yeah, well, Catherine, you actually have done a lot of work on educating what might be the theological misconceptions people have about this. So tell us first about the science on skepticism. What have you learned about skeptics?
Mm-hmm. Well, if I could dispel one myth that I think many of us believe, it's that we have to be a certain type of person to care about climate change. We have to be somebody who's already, you know, we definitely recycle. We at least consider biking to work, even if we don't do it. We think about going green, and we look longingly at solar panels in other people's houses when we drive by. The reality, I think, is that nearly every single one of us as humans already has the values we need to care about climate change in our hearts, because climate change affects all the things that we already care about. It affects our health. It affects the safety and security of our families. It affects our economy. It affects the amazing places where we grew up and love. It affects our food and our water and our energy and our national security. And it affects the refugees that we're welcoming to this country today. Part of the reason why there are so many Syrian refugees today is because there was an extraordinary drought several years ago that drove people into the country, that led to a 50% unemployment rate in Syria. And that drought was made longer and stronger because of a changing climate. So I believe that we can be any person and have the values we need to care about climate change. But what we've been told today is that you only care about it if you're a certain type of person. Now, in reality, when you look at people and you ask them what they think about climate change, people who are truly dismissive, people who you could present them with any amount of evidence and they would still say, no, that isn't true, it's just a hoax, it's a very small part of the population. Even in the US, it's only about 10% of the population. A much larger part of the population is who David was talking about, people who are doubtful or disengaged. We feel like, oh, well, we'll let those people argue it out. Whenever they, you know, decide what to do, then we'll think about it. So a lot of us are just very disengaged from this issue. We're not, you know, formally dismissive. We're just, you know, we have other things we worry about. But the reality is climate change affects those other things, and the time to do something about it is now.
And so you've talked before, it's actually moving from the States up to Canada, right? And there, and people's political lines do depend more even than their faith-based lines. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to me there's a real need that we move from taking political solutions to what these guys have articulated. Let's engage our faith on this.
Exactly.
All right, so let's start with you, Terry. Where do we begin on our Christian faith?
I mean, as I was saying, I think we have to revisit the philosophical and theological foundations on which our activities as followers of Christ have been predicated. So we have developed our theologies rooted in the idea that the fall has taken place. As Dave and I were talking at dinner, the creation has been subjected to this futility. It's subject to destruction. It's negative. It's evil. We have to avoid it. We have to find the spiritual path through this life to escape it. All of those kinds of things are part of our historical theological traditions, and they give fuel to people's doubt or their inactivity or their unwillingness to engage. I think we have to back up, and David alluded to it. I think we have to back up a chapter or two in Genesis and ask ourselves the thought, the plan, the idea, the intent of God, of our Creator, and say, what was his vision for us? And then when we engage the third chapter of the book of Genesis, we can look at it differently. We can project it. I think we have to go back to the covenant that God made, and we see that as a covenant with humanity. So if you pick up your copy of the NIV, the New Indian Version,
Did you write that, Terry?
I did.
Yeah, I thought so.
I was a part of the translation, yeah. Catherine. You see the chapter title above Genesis 9, God's Covenant with Noah, which, of course, the translation has inserted in the text. It's not part of the text. But it gives us this idea that God made a covenant with Noah. But the chapter says the covenant is with the entirety of creation. Never again will I destroy all of creation. So where do we get this idea that it's subject to destruction? Well, it comes out of course, the New Testament, that we interpret somewhat apart from and distant from this framework that the New Testament sits in called the Old Testament. And so I think we have to address our theological premises with our congregations as a part of helping them, as Catherine and David have said, begin to take some concrete actions. They've got to get their heads out of these negative theological spaces, I think.
Gordon, where does this unfold for you in theological teaching? How do you articulate this passion to, you know, the doubters, the curious, even the people who want to care?
Well, I think in part the motivation comes from international work that I've been involved in. And I think of La Paz, Bolivia, beautiful city in high in the Andes, about 2 million people if you include El Alto, and they're going to run out of water when the glacier melts. Mm-hmm. Think of people in southern Kenya, northern Tanzania, that are depending on glacial melting water from Mount Kilimanjaro. It's going to run out. And I think of farmers who are already in tropical and semi-tropical areas that are experiencing disasters with crops that are unpredictable because the weather's become unpredictable. Somehow, in the global context, being a neighbor means that I got to worry about those people. Mm-hmm. And that the mission of the church is wrapped up with the environment in which we live. How to communicate that is so tough, though.
Good thing we have a Pentecostal preacher here. So what do we do? What? How are you communicating it? Because, you know, you put that on the table yourself. Your own team has been slow to come around to the concerns of loving our neighbor because of climate change.
Yeah, although I would say some Pentecostal theologians have written some great things about creation care, and I recommend you read their stuff. But that said, as a whole, I think we've had to... you go right to your salvation narrative, and when you've made it so individualistic, which, by the way, still matters, we want transformed lives, we want transformed people, families, communities. So the transformation of the individual ends up to some degree as the end. And we've had to really take a look at, okay, in the whole narrative, what does God say about as he transforms lives, he transforms communities? So you see this desire for, in the old covenant, and that the people of God would know the shalom of God, so they'd be in right relationship with God, yes, individually, but also as a community. They'd be in right relationship with nature, but clearly they'd also be in right relationship with creation. And that's God's intended desire. Does it get messed up along the way, and do humans interfere? Yes. But through Christ and his redemption of all things, I can't imagine that God's desired narrative is anything less than our communities individually, but yes, in community with one another, would be transformed by Christ. But in that transformation, to also bring the shalom of God upon all of their relationships, their community, and the creation that they are enjoying together. And so that gets expressed both in our local settings, but yes, internationally, where you go and you are passionate to see your neighbors not suffer within creation by the brokenness where creation's groaning. Do we deny creation's groaning? How wrong is it to deny climate change? Because you're denying Romans 8. Creation is groaning. And the question is, what's our redemptive response to that? In a Pentecostal context, you always have to end up framing it in mission. Because we're empowered activists. We want to get out there and do the mission of Jesus. What I have to do with my friends is really help our constituency understand Missio Dei, the mission of God, in its integrated fashion. So you're not denying the personal transformation, salvation, individual's experience while dealing with all of these dimensions of what God's intended.
Thank you.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
I think Carrie's point was important, that it's initially, it's in a theology, but can I also say in a spirituality? Mm-hmm. It's my understanding of how I relate to God needs to drive how I relate to to the environment and to the issue of climate change. And out of that comes the mission. But this has got to have a deep spirituality to it.
Well, I think
otherwise, we won't stay in the game. We'll get discouraged.
Well, I think that's precisely right, and that's what I say. If we were to back up in Genesis 1 and 2 and talk about the nature of the shalom of God that we see in the creation narrative in 1 and 2, and then find ourselves looking at its collapse in Genesis 3, we find our relationship with God and spiritual powers has been affected, our relationship with one another in the human community has been affected, and our relationship with the rest of creation has been affected. And so our pursuit is for right relationship with God and other spiritual powers that exist. Our right relationship with one another in the human community, which I think these two guys have talked about really well, and Catherine has made very clear, and our right relatedness and relationship with the rest of creation. That's I think the thrust of mission, as it were, is the entirety of that, not simply, again, human-centered focused mission, which has tended to be individualistic, get them saved and it's done. But there are these other implications that we haven't ignored. So.
Catherine, you also are part of Evangelicals for Climate Action. Are you encouraged by the theology you're hearing here? What would you like to add to it?
I am encouraged, and it's great to hear people coming from so many different perspectives but focusing on the same key points. And I think that's why the Pope's encyclical that came out this June, Pope Francis released an encyclical this June about climate change, I think that's why it was so powerful, because so often we focus on the differences between Catholics and Protestants, and there are many differences. But the encyclical was so fundamental in its theology. It was about the fact that we have responsibility to care for the planet. We have a role and responsibility for that, certainly not detached from it, but as part of it. And the second aspect was simply the fact that people are suffering and we are to love others and care for others. So the theology is so fundamental to what we already believe that I do agree it's a case of reminding us what we believe, not introducing anything new. It's returning to the absolute basics of our faith.
And you know, there is really something neighborly happening here because, as you know, the Muslims put out their version of an encyclical,
yes,
which would be just, if not more so powerful because of their strong population base, mm-hmm, in these countries that are so deeply affected already by the effects of climate change. Let's talk a little bit then about what we can do. What's possible as activists on this, as taking a vanguard here. Gordon, what do you think we should be doing?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing we have to do is be informed, because the skeptics and the indifferent people like to jump on errors that we make. And so we need to keep up on the issues, and we need to be stubborn. I think you used that word, stubborn in our intent to keep climate change and environment issues at the forefront, because it's easy to get discouraged. There needs to be an obstinacy in the way we approach this issue, and there needs to be vision and hope. So I can say lots of other things like plant a garden, recycle, and but maybe those are two of the foundation things.
Okay, Terry, what would you say? What would you like to see us do?
You know, I think that Francis Schaeffer famously said, "How should we then live?" Addressing some fundamental issues as he saw them in the moral and social engagement of people in the society. I think the question we need to ask of ourselves and ask one another is, what will it take for us to be satisfied in our life, in terms of our consumption, in terms of our engagement in the rest of creation? What does it look like for us to be satisfied? Because it strikes me that we're still very driven by the need to continue to consume more and more. And as if somehow, you know, we do talk about it in our sermons, that leads to some greater level of satisfaction. But I'm not sure that it has or does. So my thinking would be, we need to ask the question of one another, what does it look like for us to live as satisfied people? That addresses the issue of consumption, that leads to the use of greater levels of energy, that leads to, and so forth, that escalates the climate change reality.
Okay, and David, you know, the civil society fabric that you alluded to earlier, what would you hope to see we could bring to this? What kind of action?
Yeah, so I'm thinking of me postured in the community, say through the chaplaincies, major events. I'm thinking of the apologetic of the Christian community. And I'm thinking we don't stand a chance of having especially younger Canadians take us seriously unless, because this is a socio-emotional justice question that continually comes up when I engage younger Canadians. So I need younger Canadians in my life. I need people that challenge me, and then I need people who resource me. And this may sound like a paid political announcement, but you know, Arocha has been a great gift to me because I was a denominational leader out in BC Yukon. I knew I should be greener because I live in BC, but how do you do that? You know, and Marco shows up in my life and others, you know, but the resourcing of that, the challenge of that on the one hand, as I'm at the tables of society engaging those that aren't going to let me get away, well, we're all going to hell anyway, or they're just going to hell in a handbasket anyways. There's no way that I can represent Jesus properly with that posture. And so who's going to strengthen me as the new apologetic takes effect across Canada.
Go Heather Gordon, then I'll go back to you, Terry, on our Aboriginal people helping inform that apologetic. But Gordon.
I just want to give one other stat leaves me somewhat discouraged. But in Canada this year, we sold a record number of automobiles in 2015. Never sold so many new cars. At the same time, in the city I come from, Winnipeg, we're struggling with public transit, and there's some days when I listen on the radio and some routes are cut because we don't have enough buses. And I wonder, where are the voices? Where are people speaking that this road that we're on is ultimately so destructive for our children and our grandchildren?
Well, let's talk, Terry, about what your community has been trying to bring us. And I think I first noticed it at Idle No More, which really had huge environmental concerns driving why they took to the streets as they did at that time. How do we learn and listen better from your people who, you know, in many ways are our earth keepers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is a really, really good question. I think that the climate in Canada is... thank you, Gary. I appreciated that vote of confidence in my answer. you know, the current climate in Canada where Aboriginal people are being acknowledged, not just because of the TRC and the post-TRC conversations and so on, but being acknowledged as important participants in the conversations around the use of and the kinds of extraction of energies and so on and so forth. I think that there's an openness to listen. In the Christian community, I'm often branded, and I actually noticed your eyebrows raise a little bit when I talked about being in right relationship with God and other spiritual powers.
I was thinking of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. and we're often thought of in terms of sort of these words like animism and spiritism and some and such like, but we actually do believe that not only human beings but all of creation, by reason of it having been created, is possessed of a spiritual nature. Mm-hmm. Now, human beings are differentiated from a biblical theological perspective as having been endued with the image and likeness of God, which differentiates us. But we've seen that as diminishing the spiritual nature of the rest of creation. So when the creation does groan in travail, there's this literal sense when Job talks about the rest of creation informing us, and Catherine, the science is really, the rest of creation is speaking, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, the animals upon the land, the earth itself speaks. It knows these things intuitively. There's this sense in which we've been saying this for a long time and been dismissed as spiritists and animists and pantheists and so forth. But there's this deep sense that we have always had that the rest of creation that we ourselves are part of and interconnected with has been trying to get our attention. If you will, it's been speaking to us in tongues, but we've lacked the interpreter.
No. Terry, the tongue is science.
The tongue is science, and so now we have an interpreter.
Tongue is science. Yes. So, okay.
Thank you, Catherine. That's good. I like that. I'm going to use that. So I think that, you know, and it's not that we are, you know, I mean, you get people who think somehow that when I put my ear to the ground, I can hear a deer being born in the forest, and, you know, there's that sort of idea about who we are, and if we listen really carefully, we can tell whether it's a buck or a doe, you know. It isn't quite that, but there is this sense, because we believe in the spiritual nature of all of creation, there's this sense in which we intuit things that the Western society has ascribed to a more rational cognitive engagement. And we need to re-embrace intuition. You know, things like Ignatian spirituality that have invited people to begin to engage less rational, less cognitive, and more intuitive would be helpful.
Yeah, and not only because, you know, the Aboriginal population is so small in Canada, but we have just run over you. Like, we've just, you know, mowed this intuitive.
I hadn't noticed that.
Yeah. But what happened at Idle No More, all of a sudden, bang, there it was in social media, back and forth, and on the streets, everywhere. And as we see, you know, the opposition to pipelines, the treaty renegotiations, all those things, you start to say, aha, if spiritually we would really be brothers and sisters here, we would be learning what science has been trying to warn us of. Any advice for us, Catherine, mm-hmm. into this?
Yeah. So I'm a very practical person, and often at this point in a conversation, I'm thinking, well, I'm not the prime minister. I'm certainly not a minister of anything. I'm not somebody who makes decisions for the city of Toronto or even Tyndall University. So what can I individually do? The way I think of it is I think of it in three spheres. I think of it as our individual or our family, and then I think about our community, and then I think about our province and our country. So individually, something that's really easy that we can all do, and I promise it's painless too, step on the carbon scales. What does that mean? Get on Google, look for a carbon calculator for Canada, make sure it's Canada, because that matters, and measure where our personal carbon comes from for our family. It's different depending on where we live, how many people live with us, how far we travel, what type of food we eat. Figure out where it's coming from.
Where do you get one of these carbon scales? I should know.
You just Google carbon calculator.
They're in the bathroom.
Carbon calculator. You Google it. Okay. I didn't bring them with me if I thought it would be cool to have one at the back, but it doesn't work that way.
Okay.
Google carbon calculator, enter all your info, and it'll tell you where your family's carbon comes from. And then you know, oh, well, maybe if I did this and this and this, it'll give you suggestions I can reduce it. So that's our personal sphere. But then there's our community sphere. How can I work within my neighborhood, my church, my school, my community group? Like the church, the Evangelical Church in Minnesota that decided to host a community solar garden on the church roof because it's a lot cheaper to install a huge array of solar panels than to put them individually on everybody's roof. It was a great witness to the community because they could tie in with the church. Or the church whose youth group decided to go through all of the senior citizens' homes in their neighborhood and replace their light bulbs with LEDs, cutting their energy costs and also helping people who it's really tough to get up on a ladder and change those bulbs. Or if it's the city of Dallas who decided to retrofit their buildings to be LEED certified because Dallas is working on its reputation. It LEED certified its buildings and it saved so much money that it went up to the next level. What if we did that with our churches and saved all that money that we could then give to others around the world? So there's plenty of ways that we can work within our community. But then we need to also work within our province and our country, because a lot of these solutions, like you were just talking about with Winnipeg, they can't happen alone. If we need a good transit system so we don't need that extra car or a car at all, other people have to help make that happen. And so that's why being involved with our leaders is so important. And so one of the organizations that I work with in Canada and the States is called Citizens Climate Lobby. They are an organization, yeah, I knew there'd be a few people here. They're going to have buttons on, I'm pretty sure, right? You got buttons? They normally have buttons. There's a guy right there. Because I've seen them do amazing things in the States. Citizens Climate Lobby will talk to any political leader of any stripe. The first time they show up at some hardcore Republican's door who says climate change is just a hoax, they won't even get their foot in the door. The second time, you know, a retired doctor who I know in Utah showed up, he got his foot in the door. The third time, he got to talk to the 22-year-old intern. The fourth time, he got to talk to the person up the chain. 2 years later, after that man had patiently and lovingly been visited the same elected official for 2 years, 2 years later, they were on a first-name basis, and that man came to have breakfast with me when I was in Utah to say, how can I, as a Republican, talk to people about climate change? So if that can change, think of how much more we can do here in Canada, where many of our leaders are already on board and are already wanting to do stuff, but they need to hear from us to encourage them to. So there's those three spheres mm-hmm. I feel like we can operate in.
Okay, and I want to ask...
With our faith informing all of them.
And I want to ask all of us about you know, pick a sphere and give us your advice for what you've seen as successful or something that you know you are either doing personally or provincially or federally. Gordon, what about you?
One of the things we're doing as a Canadian Baptist is working with smallholder farmers around the world as part of the Canadian Food Grains Bank. And we're urging the government of Canada to restore aid to smallholder farming to what it was in 2008 to 2010. And this relates to not only hunger, but also to climate. Mm-hmm. Because we know that the diversity, in contrast to large monocropping, the diversity of smallholder farming allows for greater protection of biodiversity and greater capture of carbon in the soil. Mm-hmm. And so this is one step that we're taking congregationally.
Wow. Okay, mm-hmm. Terry.
One of the things that I've been doing is working with chiefs and councils who will listen to encourage them to maintain a posture of responsible engagement in light of the new openness to our participation in the economic opportunities of Canada, to maintain a posture of a commitment to sustainability, to the environment, instead of simply jumping on board to get our share of the slice of the pie, and to act with integrity with the industries that we partner with. I've been encouraging and at times challenging our leadership to take a step back from getting our share of the pie to what does it look like for us to continue to think the way that our ancestors did about our role within creation as we try to bring our people into a better place of living.
And since we're starting all new government departments and leaders here, that's a really key thing for us to pray for you, that you will have influence with our Aboriginal leaders who are now welcome at, it seems, many more tables.
Indeed.
Because of that. Mm-hmm. David, what's your favorite activism trigger?
Well, through our AERDO group, we're glad to be part of the Canadian Food Grains Bank as well and those involvements. And there's a lot of international lessons and challenges that inform us. And then as a national leader, you're kind of someone to bring that back home and translate it into our current context. So right now I'm trying to expose as many of our leadership circles as possible to good resource, to think through our theology, to go the next level, to ensure there's good information flowing through our publications and every other means that we have to communicate, and just not let it be a back burner item that comes up once every 4 years, maybe because Paris happened and then it disappears. We don't want to be like the news cycles of our country where, the things disappear. We need to keep things on the front burner.
Well, thank you. I was going to say, I just like to go around at the end of the day and unplug all the things that don't need to be plugged in. But Catherine, it does matter. Individual choices also do matter, don't they? Tell me a little bit about how you, what are your favorite hobby horses that you get on about the way we just normally consume, personally? That you think actually could make a difference?
Well, the first thing I want to say is often we think, oh my goodness, we have to be very restrictive. I can only shower once a week. I can't turn on the lights anymore. And I think we have to recognize that we will still be able to do these things in new and different ways. I mean, those of you who follow tech have probably heard of somebody called Elon Musk. Yes. So after the man single-handedly replaced NASA, he then turned his mind to building batteries, and for $3.5 US, which is about 3 million Canadian, not quite, for $3,500 US, he's built this power wall that you can put in your house, so if you have solar panels or a little wind turbine, you can store your own energy. You don't even have to put it back on the grid anymore. Before he designed this, the next closest company was making one for about $40,000 or $50,000. So the tech solutions are incredible, and I get so excited about new tech. I mean, who doesn't? I'm gonna tell a story that embarrasses my husband, who is here tonight, just slightly. He, by the way, is an awesome speaker. He's speaking at People's tomorrow, People's Church, and he's doing the Toronto Spiritual Life Convention starting tomorrow night, going through Wednesday. So a couple years ago, we were here in Toronto, and the new iPhone was coming out for Christmas. In the States, you get the new iPhone the week earlier. So he had the new iPhone. So we were at Sherway Gardens, and there was a lineup of 200 people out of the Apple store waiting for their iPhone. So he pulls out his new iPhone and he walks down the line. Why did people want the iPhone? Was it because it was greener, because it was cleaner, because we should have it, because you really ought to have it, because that's what we should do? No, you want it because it's cool. So I get so excited about the awesome new technology that are making our lives better and cutting carbon emissions and saving energy and water at the same time.
Wow. Wow. Well, this has been just a fabulous conversation. And I want to bring one more person up to join us right now. I want to ask Marco Cosimo to come on up. And Mark, who is the president of Arosha Canada, and Arosha was at the summit, at the climate summit in Paris, and this was such a big thing to see so many evangelicals there this year lobbying for change. Mark, who has been a part of educating me, certainly, but all of us as the leader of Arosha, especially you as a BC guy, but he's done a fabulous job of just saying this isn't going to go away in Canada. And so if you ever can get out to Marku's place in BC, they've got an office here in Hamilton as well, but in BC it's a beautiful grounds along a salmon stream, and it's just, it's like the Shire, just tucked right there in the Vancouver area there. But we want to just say thank you to all of the panelists, and a special thank you to you, Catherine. So let's give it up for our panelists.